Brand new luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen. Brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3 bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com.
Dreaming of blissful summer days and creamy popsicles? Capture sun-drenched memories with the Orange Vanilla Dream Hydration Multiplier from Liquid IV. Just one stick and 16 ounces of water can help hydrate you better than water alone. Live your summer dream with Liquid IV. Tear, pour, live more. Go to liquidiv.com and get 20% off your first order with code INDULGE20 at checkout.
Brand new luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen. Brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3 bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com.
This is Hidden Killers with Tony Bruschi.
Lori Daybell. Lori. Effing Daybell, as we like to refer to her around here. Oh my gosh, the trial is underway. I've been watching as much as I possibly can of it. We've been bringing you a lot of clips, the opening statements on both sides, and kind of breaking down stuff piece by piece. But a man who's been literally watching it play by play, Bob Mata, defense attorney, host of the podcast Defense Diaries. I'm going to throw it to you because you've seen more of this than I have thus far. What the hell's your take on it?
Well, number one, hey, what's up, T?
Hey.
It's been a minute.
Yeah.
Welcome back. Welcome back.
Thank you. You too.
It's boring so far.
Yes.
It's like the key kind of phrase that I can think of, the best way to describe it thus far. It's like any state case, it kind of clunks out of the gate a little bit. And, you know, they're putting on the witnesses, kind of building the timeline. And, you know, ultimately we'll start getting into the juicier stuff in terms of the real evidence that can prove that she was a part of the conspiracy. But right now we're just, you know, with the first responders, you know, the first cop to the scene, hear a little bit from those folks, and then kind of like forced to listen through Lori's inane cross-examinations where it's hard to describe what she's doing. She's not. Like, she's asking all these questions. It feels more like a deposition.
Yeah, like, what I'm trying to put my finger on what direction she's trying to go, because I don't know that she knows what she's trying to do, where she's trying to go or what she's trying to do.
She doesn't. She has no idea. Yeah. I mean, you can't.
No.
You know, I mean, trying a case is not easy. It's not easy for lawyers, and it's certainly not going to be easy for somebody who's tried to prep themselves in prison.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, it's going to be a very challenging endeavor for her, you know, but do I feel any pity? Absolutely not. She made her choice. She's mm-hmm. the smartest person in the room. So, you know, she's going to reap what she sows through the end of this thing. And, you know, ultimately I have very little doubt that she'll be found guilty. I will say that as far as her opening went, she was competent. You know, I mean, I didn't think that she was like a bumbling fool up
yeah.
there.
Yeah.
I thought that she had a pretty linear timeline. I thought that she kind of like hit her points. You could tell that she had worked on that for a long time. You could tell her advisory counsel told her to use the phrase, the evidence will show, over and over and over. You know,
like to a fault. It was like, I think she thought she had to begin every sentence with it, no matter what, even if she was talking about evidence or not.
Right. Exactly. Well, and the interesting thing is that she made a lot of promises, mm-hmm. right? I mean, she made a lot of promises with that phrase, the evidence will show. And I don't know how she's delivering any of that to the jury short of her testifying, because everybody that was in that home is no longer with us.
Yeah.
So, you know, like, I mean, she's literally the only person who's alive that could get any of that into evidence as to what happened in that house. So, I mean, it raises the question, is she going to testify? Now, that poses a huge issue for her because that's what brings in her criminal record.
Mm-hmm.
Background. If she testifies, the state gets to bring her entire criminal history in. Mm-hmm. And, you know, whether or not these jurors know about her, it's hard to say. I imagine that some of them probably do.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I mean, that's a real battle for her. You know, I mean, that's just because of human nature. I mean, they're not supposed to take those convictions into consideration in terms of whether or not she's guilty of this crime, but that's not how human beings work.
Mm-hmm.
It's just not what we do. You know, I mean, it's all kind of part and parcel of the same story, isn't it? It doesn't really matter that things took place at different times. It was all part of the grand scheme of things. So, yeah. You know, whether or not the jury's aware of it, if she decides that she's going to testify, it's all coming in. You know, I mean, it has to. So because that's part of the deal. You know, if you get on, because they have the ability to be able to challenge your credibility. And one of the ways of doing that is bringing in your criminal history. So
is that like pretty much, though, a guaranteed you're going to be found guilty, Lori Vallow, if you decide to testify in this? I mean, I didn't see anything she's possibly going to say by testifying herself that would outweigh bringing in JJ and Tylee's death. I don't know what that could possibly be.
I agree. And, you know, it's kind of it's a double-edged sword for her because mm-hmm. it at the heart of it, it is a defense of others / self-defense type defense that she's putting on in mm-hmm. terms of she's claiming that her brother was defending Tylee
mm-hmm.
and, you know, that's why this whole thing went down. And, you know, short of her getting on to the stand and saying what happened in there, how is she getting that story out? You know what I mean? Yeah. And it's like, if she doesn't do it, I just don't know how she's going to deliver on her side of the story at all.
You know, yeah, there's really
nobody else in there.
There's no one that's alive that can speak to this anymore. Right. Were you surprised? I mean, no, I was a little bit surprised. Let's go back to the opening statements that we had from Lori. My bar was pretty low on this of what to expect. I was surprised actually how well she did on her opening arguments there. And I was also surprised that she didn't bring religion into it at all yet. I was expecting some, you know, zombie-ish something in there, but she seemed to have enough competence to go, maybe not yet, or maybe not at all. I don't know. What was your reaction to that?
Yeah, same. And, you know, the state had, they certainly didn't dive deep into the religious side of it either. Mm-hmm. They certainly brought up like the knee-high stuff, you know, because they're going to tie that up and they're going to do that with respect to what, you know, translating what these text messages between Lori and Alex meant,
mm-hmm.
you know, and they're like, those are going to be the smoking gun evidence for them. And they're going to have to bring it in to a certain extent, whether or not it's going to be anywhere near what we saw in the first trial. I don't think so.
Yeah.
And I don't think that they should. I think this is a much cleaner story for the state without having to get into all of that.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, like they're not having to really create the narrative for the jury as to like how this mother came to ending her own two children's lives like they did the first time, wherein, you know, showing kind of like where her brain had gone in its delusional state mm-hmm. with respect to thinking that the kids were demons and they were no longer, you know, in there and that they were just vessels. And it was like, so, you know, it's like for that kind of stuff, they had to bring that in because they had to be able to show, look,
yeah,
this is where her head was. Like, this is why she did it. This was her motive. And, you know, and I mean, they charged her with, you know, still collecting the Social Security benefits, but like that wasn't enough money to be a true motive. Like mm-hmm. they had to show that she was just warped, you know, that mm-hmm. This is what she was thinking, that she thought the end of days were coming. She didn't think that her kids were her kids anymore. And that was the reason. Here, it's a very different case for them, in the sense that I think they have to bring a little of it in,
yeah.
but they don't have to bring in the full weight of it, which I think is good, mm-hmm. you know, because I think it'll get confusing to the jurors if they're not going to go all in. Like that's just not a story. You can kind of cherry pick a few things and throw it in there. And if you've got jurors that are not familiar with her story and the background of the case, they're going to be like, what does any of this mean? You know what I mean? Cause like I kind of felt when I was listening to the state's opening statements that it was a little disjointed. Mm-hmm. I didn't think it was bad, mm-hmm. but I thought it was a little kind of a little hit or miss in terms of like, is the jury able to discern what they're getting at here?
Yeah.
You know, it's like kind of stick on the bigger things, like, okay, well, Charles had the life insurance policy, money was the motive here, you know, and ultimately she wanted to be with Chad. So she had these two things that were going on. And without really having to dive deep into the religious side of it, mm-hmm. you know, but I mean, there is a pretty big Mormon population in Arizona as well.
Yeah.
You know, so it's not as if, you know, you're trying to tell this story to like a Chicago jury mm-hmm. where, you know, Mormonism and LDS isn't as big out here.
Yeah.
You know, where you're going to have a lot of people like, what does any of this mean?
You get laughed out of the room. Yeah.
Right. So, I mean, we'll see how it plays out, but, you know, to me, the biggest question is going to be whether or not she's going to testify.
What's your thoughts on the story that she's presenting, in her opening arguments, that it was, Alex was trying to defend Tylee from a rageful Charles Vallow who was going to swing a bat at her. Although there really had been no documented abuse whatsoever between Charles and the kids, and I'm wondering with that, you know, we said nobody's around to talk about. Colby is,
yeah, for sure. Now I don't think Colby was living with them
yeah.
at the time.
I know,
but we do know that Colby and Tylee talked all the time.
Yeah,
you know, I think they were tight. So in terms of, you know, but then that becomes a hearsay situation. How was he able to get in those conversations?
Sure.
So, I mean, she represented that there was like some video that exists as to some of these interactions between Charles and Tylee, how she's going to get those in or if they really exist.
That's the question. Do they exist? You know?
Right. You know, so, I mean, we're going to have to wait and see. You know, I mean, that's going to have to be her story.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it was always, that's what I was saying. I mean, she's coming in with this defense of another situation, and I just don't know how she gets there without testifying, man. I just don't.
I don't know. I'm trying to understand what the big deal with the CPR argument has been thus far, because we've been hearing it from the state and from her. What's the point of this argument? We know he was shot. The first officer has said, you know, when I got there, he was not revivable. It was one of those things. It just is what it is. But there seems to be like, I don't know where she's going with her arguments, and it may be absolutely nowhere, but it still seems to be somewhat of a focus. I mean, as of today, as of where we're at with technically day three of the trial as we're recording this.
Yeah, I think that her bigger purpose was there was a 47 minute gap from the time that they think that Charles was shot mm-hmm. to when Alex calls 911.
Sure.
You know, I mean, the argument from the state certainly would be that they had to make sure that he was dead mm-hmm. and that he was not revivable before they called 911. So that's kind of their thing. And then the other part of it is that the state's going to insinuate that Alex never actually tried to do CPR on him.
Mm-hmm.
So that's where you got into the cracking of the sternum.
Yeah.
And you know, why that kind of stuff hadn't happened, and would blood be gushing out of the wound if Alex had been performing CPR on the chest. So that was kind of her thing. She was trying to establish that they don't have any way of proving that Alex did not perform CPR, because that's a damaging fact for, mm-hmm. you know, for Lori and for Alex Cox, in terms of their narrative that he shot in self-defense and that, you know, he was directed by 911 to try to revive him, and, you know, talking him through the CPR, and, you know, the state's narrative is going to be that he didn't try anything. He just sat there looking at him. So that's what she was trying to get in. I think that was the purpose of a lot of her questions, was to establish that, you know, somebody who's not familiar with doing CPR and isn't, you know, doing the compressions with the amount of pressure that you need to, that they wouldn't necessarily have broken that sternum and cracked ribs trying to press down. Whereas with first responders who know what they're doing and whose number one, you know, goal is to get that person resuscitated, you know, oftentimes they will crack bones when they're trying to do it, because you're trying to get to the heart in order to get that thing pumping again. So, you know, I think that that was ultimately what her point was, because at the end of the day, it's going to be pretty damaging facts for Lori in terms of whether or not Alex actually tried to resuscitate him. So, you know, I mean, I think she did what she could. She's got obviously no medical background.
Yeah.
And, you know, her trying to cross-examine people that have, you know, knowledge and experience in doing that was pretty clunky.
Obviously, this is a conspiracy case. This is not that Lori Vallow is the one who pulled the trigger. It's that she was conspiring with her brother, Alex, who is now dead, to kill Charles Vallow. Are they going to have a difficult time proving this? Because you got to show why would Alex want to do her bidding? I know, you know, bidding, you know, motive, I know you don't have to prove, but it's kind of a big part of this in a conspiracy to show, okay, why would this guy, why would he do it? Why would he go kill people for Lori? How are they going to establish that in the case like this?
And that's part of the challenge for the state in this case, because they're not going to theoretically delve into all of the other parts of the story, because either they've chosen not to, or because they were barred from doing it. And I mean, anybody who knows the story knows that Alex was her henchman. You know, I mean, he was the guy doing all the dirty work for Chad and Lori. And, you know, I mean, I think that there's a lot of people, including myself, that think that they had a hand in his untimely death from a pulmonary embolism. That I think that there's, if you do even a basic Google search, you can see that you can facilitate that. You know, by basically pumping air into somebody's, you know, it's essentially just getting an air bubble in there, and you can cause that to happen. How they're going to be able to prove it up is going to be challenging without getting that side of the story in. It's going to boil down to these text messages between Lori and Alex. You know, that's why I was saying, that's why I think that they brought up the, you know, the Nephi stuff. They're going to explain what that meant, what the significance of it is in these text messages. And that, you know, for them, it was kind of, you know, the lingo that they spoke and that was, you know, that was her giving directions, and that was her inquiring as to if things were done and, you know, was it finished, you know? And I mean, they're going to have to build it through circumstantial evidence that, you know, they stayed away from the house for a very long period of time. They're at the Walgreens, and they're at the Burger King, and, you know, all those things. And you heard the word, the strange chocolate milkshake testimony. You know, and I think that that was, that the cop brought that up because of the amount of melting that had occurred with the shake, you know, because it was really hot out that day. So, you know, the cop was trying to say, well, according to the milkshake, you know, they had been out there for a minute, or, you know, they had just gotten back from Burger King because it was still pretty much frozen, you know. So it's got different challenges in the first case, that's for certain.
Well, and some of it just shows how ridiculous the story is without, it's like, show me how ridiculous this is without showing me how ridiculous this is. You find out that your husband is dead or murdered, and you take the kids to Burger King. I mean, it's just like, I mean, I wouldn't even be taking them to school. You know, it'd be like, let's go to my friend's house today. I have to go deal with this, and then I'll come get you, and we can talk about this when we need to. It's like, take him to Burger King, take him to school, just like it's an ordinary day. And she backs it up in the opening statements of, I took them because he promised that he would take them. So I had, you know, basically had to fulfill that Burger King promise.
Yeah, it's, like, I mean, when you see the interview there,
yeah,
like with the cop and her, and she like, it just is not a woman who has any compassion.
No,
you know, it's like, if you were watching that, not knowing what happened, what preceded it, you would have no idea that anybody that she knew.
You think she was like the neighbor,
right? Like, or and purportedly cared about at some point in her life. I mean, she had to have cared about it. They were together for a long time. Mm-hmm. You would assume that there was some point in time that she had feelings for him, and you just saw no indication of it, you know, at all in that interview. And I'm talking about when they're standing outside of the house, mm-hmm. and you see Ty Lee over there, just kind of standing there, and they're asking her questions, and she's just, you know, chuckling and just talking about it. Like, it's the weirdest thing. And it just really goes to her mindset. Like, I think that's very powerful evidence in terms of the jury's going to be looking at it. Like, what is going on with this woman? You know, like, that is just not a normal human response for a situation like that to have occurred, you know, an hour prior, you know, it's like all those little things. It's going to be putting together all these little pieces in the circumstantial case. Again, like most cases, wherein you're going to have to be able to create this picture for the jury where there's going to be holes. But when they step back and they look at the totality of the circumstances and they see the picture of the puzzle that the state's put together, even with those little holes in the story, that you still see what the full picture is. And you know, I think they'll be able to get there. But, you know, obviously I'm curious to see what they're going to do to be able to get that conspiracy charge like nailed, because mm-hmm. you do have to show agreement, you know, I mean, you have to meet each and every element. It's like, I was telling Allie, cause we had covered the first trial in depth.
Yeah.
And you know, in that case, like I had always felt, I'm like, this is one of those cases where this woman's gallivanting around in Hawaii when her kids are allegedly missing mm-hmm. and doesn't seem to have a care in the world, is out buying wedding rings, is doing all the things that she did. And I just thought that the backstory of that was going to lead the jury to the conclusion that this woman had a hand in it without them having to meet each and every element, which is required by law, mm-hmm. but this is one of those cases where I just didn't think that they were going to need to do it, because the jury's going to be like, I don't care that they met each and every element. No woman that didn't have a hand in it would have been acting like that.
Sure.
Like no parent would be doing that. So, you know, she's going down. Here it's a little bit of a different circumstance because again, you're not getting into all of the Ty Lee and JJ story, you know, mm-hmm. not to the extent that they did the first time. This is a like kind of an isolated incident mm-hmm. and, you know, and it predates all the other stuff mm-hmm. and like, they're going to have to just sell the concept of she wanted to be with Chad and she wanted that money, mm-hmm. you know, and those two things were the driving motivation for her. And, you know, they'll be able to bring in that her and Chad were married very soon after, you know, and without her getting on the stand to put up some kind of defense and give her version of the story, I don't know how she's going to rebut it.
I don't know how she would rebut it either. I mean, we clearly know the state is going to bring in the whole Nephi thing and the whole wacky belief system there that they thought, you know, he was possessed by Ned. I always want to say Ned Ryerson, and I know it's not. Ned Ryerson? Yeah. Boom!
He's a very religious guy.
Yeah, I know it's not Ned Ryerson from Groundhog's Day, but
or Ned Flanders.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, or Ned Flanders.
Yeah.
Why they picked Ned, I don't know. Just what came to their mind. But they're going to, I mean, this is all going to be out there. This is all going to be presented. And I wonder how triggering it will be to her when this stuff is presented on how she's going to handle anything on cross for anybody. And what, you know, what is she going to do? What is she going to say? Is she going to go down that road of treating her belief system as if it is fact and everyone else in the room is crazy? That I think will be a very telling point when these sort of things get out and we get out of just the CPR area of the testimony that we're hearing about with Charles being on the ground.
Yeah, I mean that's the testimony that makes this thing worth watching.
Yeah.
Is like, see, when we get to that kind of aspect of the case, how she's gonna handle it. Mm-hmm. Like, is she gonna go full nuts?
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, it's like you know, we've heard her. We've heard her, you know. I mean, her theory is that we're all wrong and she's right. She's got it from up on high that, you know, everything that she thinks is the way that it's going to go down. And we're the ones who are nuts and, you know, that we should believe her. So, I mean, is she going to put that on display? I mean, she's got to realize that we do think that she's all nuts. And the jury is going to think she's nuts as well. So whether or not she believes in her heart of hearts and in her diseased mind that we are the crazy ones, that we're the ones who are just out of the loop because we don't believe her, is she smart enough to realize that that's not going to be an effective way to get a not guilty in this case? Because insulting the jury is the first way to get yourself convicted in a case. So it's going to be interesting.
She obviously has her own list of witnesses that she plans on calling, at least some of them. How is there any way, shape or form that you see any of these people helping her? Or is it just going to be more folks that are going to end up sinking her on cross from the prosecution?
I anybody that was a part of the story, I can't see any of them helping her. You know, if you've got like an expert or two, which I think that she does, obviously that she's going to have to lean into those folks.
Yeah.
She, again, you know, this is the challenge of going pro se, you know, it's that old axiom, you know, the lawyer who represents themselves as a fool for a client, you know, and she is the lawyer in this situation. And, you know, and you're too close to the situation to be able to look at things objectively. That's why you have other people represent you. You have to be able to take a step back and say, okay, well, this isn't going to work because of X, Y, and Z. And I don't think that she's going to be capable of doing that. I think that she thinks that she's going to be able to, you know, kind of manipulate her way to whatever she needs people to say on the stand. And it's just not going to work out in her favor. But I mean, we'll see. Like, I mean, like she needs to have a very, very slim case.
Yeah.
Like she's like, if she thinks she's going to parade a bunch of people up there, they're going to be in any way helpful to her. I think that she's in for a rude awakening.
Yeah. Less is more with her, I would think. At the end of the day, when the jury does get this, let's say that she never does testify. We never end up hearing anything about Tylee or JJ or her past criminal acts. And they're discussing this. Let's say some of the jurors do know about the past a bit. Are they allowed to discuss any of that in the jury room at the end of like, well, I do know this about this, or do they have to completely keep it strictly to the evidence that was presented in this case, whether they have any knowledge of anything in the past or not, to enlighten maybe those who don't?
Yeah, no, they have to stick to the facts and evidence that were presented. You can't bring in anything else that wasn't part of the case in chief of either side. You can't do it.
Yeah.
So, you know, but again, what you can and can't do.
They're humans.
I mean, that's the thing. It's like.
That's what I'm wondering, though. Like if it does get brought up somehow, somebody's discussing, they're like, well, she also killed her kids. What? You know, is there any safeguards to prevent that from happening in the conversation in the jury room? Is there anybody there that's a third party that can be like, whoa, this is not part of the case. We can't be doing hearsay of what you heard. Or does this just I don't know how that works technically.
Yeah, technically, no, there is no safeguard. There is no like when they're back there alone. There's nobody back there with them. And there is. If somebody brings it up and you've got, you know, you can't unring a bell situation happens back there, it happens.
Could that be looked at as prejudicial? Like if later after everything is done and if she tries to do an appeal on this, I don't know if she will, but because it's her. But let's say that we found out that somebody did bring this up in jury when they're deliberating. Could that be looked at as, wait a second, this should not have happened. They brought this up. They weren't supposed to. That constitutes this wasn't a fair trial because a juror introduced prejudicial information to other jurors in the jury room.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah.
It could definitely, you know, the question is, how is she finding that out? You know, because like none of the jurors are going to be chatting with her.
Yeah, I mean, if somebody speaks out in an interview later, something like that, where like, then they talked about this, because inevitably some of these folks are going to talk and they're going to share their experience and write a book or whatever. So, I mean, if that comes out that happened, there's just it seems like a very open and shut case, but it seems like there's a lot of pitfalls here that people could fall in as well, just to play by the rules. So we don't have that sort of issue. But again, people are human that. You don't sometimes even know where the pits are.
Well, you hope that there's at least one juror back there that's like a rule follower.
Yeah,
say, whoa.
Yeah.
You can't bring that up. We can't consider that at all.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, that cures the issue. And that ultimately the juror is going to have to say, well,
I
mean, but it was brought up, but it didn't play into why we convicted her. You know, I mean, like that's ultimately what it's going to have to boil down to. If somebody let slip that came out in deliberations, you know, that her sordid background makes its way into the deliberation room and people learn of things that they didn't learn through the trial, it would get dealt with. I don't think that it would ever succeed in any way, shape or form, especially, you know, if you've got a juror who's going to say, all right, look, we can't consider that because they get an instruction on it. I mean, the safeguard is that, they get a jury instruction on it that you're not to consider anything that wasn't brought up in trial in terms of the facts and the evidence that was presented to you. You can't bring up anything that people may know from outside sources. It's not a part of this equation.
Yeah.
And as long as you've got a juror or two or more back there that are like, we can't consider that. Mm-hmm. You're like, I get it. I hear what you're saying, but that has nothing to do with this case. I think it'll be fine.
It will be interesting.
Craving nonstop true crime updates? Press subscribe now and get the latest cases, analysis, and expert commentary delivered straight to your feed. Only from the Hidden Killers podcast and True Crime Today.
Brand new luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen. Brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3 bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com. Brand new luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen. Brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3 bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com. Brand new luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen. Brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3 bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com. Brand new luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen. Brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3 bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com. Brand new luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen. Brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3 bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com. Brand new luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen. Brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3 bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com. Brand new luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen, brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3 bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com.